This podcast is brought to you by Voice of Vets. Voice of Vets. Hear it. Feel it. Feel it. Feel it. Feel it. Feel it.
Joining us at this time, Professor Ahmed Bawa, who is the CEO of Universities South Africa, talking to us about the work that they are engaging in to help these students out. Professor Bawa, thank you so much for joining us here on the COVID Report. As I said just now, it has been over 6 months since universities, along with the students and the academic profession, was forced to adapt to online learning. What are some of the challenges that you would say have persisted over the period?
But let me begin by thanking you for having me on the program. And I always enjoy being on the Voice of Vets. It's a wonderful opportunity again. Some of the challenges we faced are fairly well known by now. One of them clearly is just the issue around the accessibility of online learning to many students in our system. That had to do with three or four different things. The one was just the issue around the availability of devices to students. Secondly, the issue around connectivity. And the connectivity issue, by the way, was partly to do with the data being available, but also to do with connectivity for students in rural areas, just the fact that there isn't sufficient mobile phone coverage, if you like, mobile data coverage in many parts of our country. And then thirdly, just the issue around students having decent workspaces, just where they could connect with their universities in an environment where it was suitable for learning. So those were issues relating to the circumstances for students to connect. But there were two or three other major issues. The one is just the fact that some of our universities did not have the systems in place to make a rapid transition into some form of online learning. And secondly, it was the preparedness of staff at some of our universities to engage in online delivery of courses and so on. So there were multiple issues, it seems to me, and while some of our universities have done exceptionally well in these circumstances in doing this rapid transition, if you like, others struggled quite a lot, and I think that what we've emerged with is a fairly mixed picture, if you like, as we kind of do an analysis now of that transition round about March, April, May.
Now, the lockdown in many ways was a sobering reminder of the gross inequalities at play. And when we narrow it down to the education sector, there were many instances where schools in parts of the country were exposed to be grossly unequal in comparison to the other schools. And when it comes to institutions of higher learning and how they've had to try to make the academic year of 2020 work with so many of these inequalities at play, we've seen that some students who had adequate infrastructure like access to a laptop and Wi-Fi have been gravely disadvantaged. So can you please take us through which universities struggled the most and what support has been provided to them?
Yeah, thank you for that, Gamalihle. And I think we have to begin by saying that the universities started out with the intention that they would all be able to switch over to some form of online learning. Until, of course, when attempts were made to do that, it turned out that there were many difficulties. And clearly what COVID-19, what the pandemic has done to us is really kind of emphasized, if you like, just how deeply unequal we are as a society. This is not just in the area of education. It's also true in the health sector. It's true in the food security sector and so on. So it's multiple areas in which we are, where this inequality has been highlighted by COVID-19. So I think what the universities, what all 26 universities arrived at was some kind of understanding that the important thing was to put in place a multiple approaches, if you like, to completing the academic year. And what that meant essentially was that at some institutions, the emphasis wasn't totally on online learning, but that there was also this commitment to bring students back onto campus so that students could complete the academic year through a kind of a blended learning approaches on campus, if you like. So the emphasis wasn't on saying, let's complete the academic year with online learning, but rather saying, let's use what you might think of as a multimodal approach, you know, to completing the academic year. And I think that's the reason why we are seeing this very staggered end to the academic year. Some universities are going to complete the academic year at the end of November. Some are going to finish only at the end of March. Right? And that's partly because we had to wait for the for this pandemic to re-peak and for the peak to get down to a level where we could bring back the students onto campus, if you like, to complete the academic year. So now you raised the question about the schools, and I think that that has been that's going to be a huge challenge for us, I think, as we head into the future, because in a sense, we really don't know yet, just what the impact of COVID-19 has been on those schools where facilities have not been available. And I think that we're still going to count the score on that. I think it's going to be what we are going to find, in fact, is that there's going to have to be a massive intervention, as the pandemic slows down to get students to the point where they are not disadvantaged, if you like. And I think that what this has pointed out is the fact that we have to adopt a national approach to address the inequalities. So one of the things that we are talking about now in the higher education sector is the development of a national platform for teaching and learning that will be accessible to all 26 universities, so that we don't depend on the capacity of each university to create the platform that is required, but that they can depend on a national platform on which to build a kind of blended learning and sort of online learning more generally, if you like. I think what I'm saying is that we need a national approach to the provision of data, the provision of technology, the provision of devices and so on, rather than, expect each institution to do that of its own accord when there are such deep inequalities between institutions.
Now, there has been a contribution by Standard Bank, Prof. Please can you share more on this contribution and which six universities will benefit from the contribution?
Yeah, first of all, I think that we have to thank the Standard Bank and various other donors, by the way, for coming to the table. Standard Bank's commitment has been to six institutions, and these were six institutions that were regarded as being at highest risk, if you like, for not being able to complete the academic year. And that definition was really laid out by the definition of universities at risk was really laid out by DAGT. And I'm very pleased to say, in fact, that those six institutions are no longer kind of in that danger list, if you like. I mean, they've all been elevated out of that list. So all of them are now very much on track to completing the academic year. So Standard Bank's contribution, together with other donors, I have to say, has really kind of focused in on three major things. The one is the provision of data, the provision of devices, and also some contribution towards food security, if you like, just providing allowances to students who might be at risk of not being able to complete the academic year because of lack of funding. And the donations were, as far as I can remember, sort of 500,000 rand each. So it's not a huge amount of money, but it's a very important pot of money for students that were at severe risk, if you like.
Now, Professor Bauer, we're exploring the idea of the missing middle when it comes to students on this edition of the COVID report. Perhaps first explain to us what the missing middle students actually means. And then could you take us through how many students we have in the country who are considered to be in the missing middle?
Yeah, that's a really good question, you know, because we really don't have a firm kind of definition of what we mean by students in the missing middle. Yeah, this was a phrase that kind of arose during the Fees Must Fall and Roads Must Fall campaigns. But generally speaking, the way we would think about the missing middle is that it's students who come from working class families, but who fall outside of the category of students who qualify for NISFAS grants. So, in other words, it's students who come from families where the family income is outside of the NISFAS threshold. And then, I suppose, going up to a family income of about 600,000. So that's the kind of category of students that we would be talking about. So one of the most important developments during this period has been this idea that NISFAS, those students that qualify for the NISFAS managed DHET bursaries, that those students will in the future receive devices. So that's a really important new development, and it's a development which really addresses a very serious shortfall, if you like, you know, in our system. But that doesn't address the needs of students of those students that we kind of refer to as students in the missing middle. So it's students who do not qualify for NISFAS grants because their family income is above the NISFAS threshold, and then have a family income of up to 600,000. Or something like that. So it's those students, in fact, that were most supported by both the Standard Bank grant and the grants of other donors like APSA and so on, that came to the party to support this development.
Speaking more on the criteria used to allocate which students would benefit from the grant, is it only vulnerable students that are going to be prioritized? And are Standard Bank and some of the other donors going to play a part in determining the criteria that is going to be used?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think I must say that, you know, that a part of the decision making on the part of the banks and other donors is really is done in consultation, you know, with USAF and with the universities and so on. But at the same time, of course, at the end of the day, it's the donor that decides, you know, just how the allocations are to be made. To your question, I think it needs to be emphasized that it is indeed students who are at risk of not being able to complete the academic year, vulnerable students, as you point out, that it is really vulnerable students who are being supported by these, you know, with these grants that have been received. And I think that, it is an attempt, I suppose, to try and ensure that students who fall just outside of the NISFAS kind of threshold, you know, that they are not left in the lurch, if you like, because it would be next to impossible for those students to receive, for example, loans from banks and so on, because of the very small family earnings of those students. Yeah.
Insightful stuff, Professor Bauer. Now, we've also talked at length about the way in which this pandemic has changed the landscape for the education sector. Now, in your view, as the CEO of University South Africa, can you take us through what long-lasting changes you've observed that the pandemic has brought to universities across the country?
Yeah, I think that's really the fundamental question, you know, about the future. And I want to just begin by saying that, there are two major issues that we have to focus on in the next period of time. I mean, the one is just the short-term financial crisis. I mean, we have to remind ourselves, you know, there's been a huge repurposing of university budgets, if you like, to manage the crisis that we faced with the pandemic, if you like. So, you know, money that would have been spent on research or would have been spent on new equipment or a range of maintenance of our buildings and so on, much of that money would have been repurposed, you know, for dealing with the emergencies of online learning or the purchasing of the preparation of our campuses for the return of students and so on, to deal with the public health protocols and so on. So there's a tremendous shortfall already, and what we've seen also is a small decline in government subsidy for this year already. But what we've also encountering is just massive cuts to the funding of research at our universities. So that's a really major issue, the short term financial crisis. But there's also deep fears about the long-term sustainability of our universities because of the dependence of our universities on government subsidy, tuition fees, and so on. All of those are under pressure, if you like, for the longer term. And so there are deep concerns about the sustainability of our universities. But I think the question that you are posing is a slightly different one. I think what you are really asking about is what changes can we expect in higher education because of COVID-19? And I would like to just focus on three things. The one is just the idea that we have to work more seriously as a sector rather than simply as a kind of leaving institutions to solve the problems by themselves. So I mentioned earlier this idea of developing a shared services platform for teaching and learning, for research management, for the procurement of journals, and so on. So in other words, saying that we really have to work as a sector more effectively so that we can address these inequalities and the shortfalls that some of our universities experience. The second is the impact of COVID-19 on the modalities of teaching and learning. And I think that what we are going to see is the much higher levels of the use of technology in teaching and learning. Now, I'm not suggesting that we're all going to become, that all of our universities are going to become distance universities, distance education universities. That's not going to be the case. But I think that there's going to be a much heavier dependence on students receiving their materials online. And then instead of having large classes, what you'll have is small group tutorials and so on, which will be much more intensive for learning purposes. So in other words, I think what we'll see is a kind of a more traditional approach to learning, just kind of the approach that would be where students would read up materials on their devices and so on online, and then attend intensive tutorials, which will really kind of lead to much more interactive learning and so on. So, I'm of the view that that has enormous potential to improve the quality of teaching and learning at our universities. I don't accept the idea, that face-to-face learning is going to disappear. I mean, some people are speaking about that. I don't buy that idea, simply because I think that the role of universities in shaping the new nation, in building new generations of intellectuals, in increasing the critical awareness of our graduates, and so all of that requires face-to-face engagement. We can't possibly imagine that those roles of the university, those critical roles of the universities, are somehow going to disappear. So I think that once we enter this area of blended learning, what it might also do is provide the basis for us to have increased access to higher education, so that where students might be much more kind of brought into academic programs on the basis that they spend time on campus and spend time off campus. So that might be a possibility down the line. And I think that that is really going to be the major kind of change, it seems to me. But all of that really does depend on students having devices, students having access to connectivity and so on. So we have to get all of those things right before we kind of embark on those kinds of initiatives. The challenge we face is that all of this costs money, and we know that the economy isn't doing well and so on. So it really does depend on us kind of adopting a kind of a national approach to this rather than leaving it to individual institutions to do it.
Now, this plan seems to really change the face of education as we know it for us students. But then this brings up the question of How would this possibly affect the way in which universities deliver teaching, more especially to the missing middle students who, to some extent, were already struggling with the form of delivery previously, who struggled during the COVID time?
I think that's a really critical question. And I think that, you know, it really takes me back to the point that we have to find a solution to these issues. So the access to devices and the access to connectivity. And also it's about trying to ensure that students are sort of geared for this kind of learning. You know, so not everybody is geared for online learning, it seems to me. So it is about getting these things right, if you like. And by the way, building the capacity of universities to do this properly so that students aren't getting a poor version, if you like, of online learning. So I think that, you know, what the universities have been able to do is to put in place systems that allows students in the missing middle to gain access to devices and so on. Now, of course, this isn't true at all universities, but certainly at most of our universities, that has been the case. And again, I just want to emphasize, we need a national solution to this. This can't be left to chance, if you like. Yeah? There has to be a national solution. And I think that what it means essentially is that if a student registers at any one of our universities, and in the event that that student can't afford access to a device and to data and so on, that there is a national system in place which ensures that students have access to a device and data and so on. So so it takes me back to both questions that you know, the question about the both questions that have been raised. The one is, you know, for the university system, let's adopt a national approach to this. Let's find a national solution to it. And for the school sector, you know, we really can't have such inequalities between our schools. You know, so that's a political question, it seems to me. And, you know, and I think that our government has to step up and really address this issue of inequality. You know, we can't continue to operate on the basis that the apartheid categories that we have, you know, in terms of, you know, the different kinds of schools we have, that persists into the future. I mean, it's been 25 years now, 26 years since change has come to South Africa, and we still kind of have these different categories of schools. And that's just not on. You know, we really have to pressurize our government to make to have the political will to make the changes that are required.
So, Professor Bauer, my next question would then is, how would this type of intervention help bridge the gap between the private sector and public education? And moreover, does this shine a new light on the importance of private companies and NGOs partnering, more so during a pandemic? And how does the importance of this partnership between NGOs and private companies become even more important?
No, I think that, Gabriele, I think that that's a really critical question again. I mean, I thank you for these really important questions. You know, the unemployment rate of graduates in South Africa is low. It's about 6% or something like that. It's between 6 and 7%, you know, compared to 30%, you know, in the general public and 40 to 50% for youth in South Africa. Now, that's an indication that there's still a very strong absorption rate of graduates, you know, in the economy. And now the reason I'm giving you this data is because I think that there needs to be a strong understanding in the private sector, you know, that the graduates that are produced by the universities are vital to their operations. and that they have to see this as an indication that as an indication of a sub responsibility on their side to partner with higher education, and that's why I think, you know, that this that the step that has been taken by Standard Bank, Absa Bank, and various other donors, that's why I think it's such an important step on their part, because what it indicates is some kind of understanding that they have a role to play in ensuring that our university sector operates at an optimal level. At the end of the day, you know, their productivity and their kind of ability to generate profits and so on depends on the effectiveness of the graduates that enter employment in the private sector. So this need for a partnership is a hugely important one. I should just mention that at University of South Africa, we've established a strategy group, which we call the World of Work Strategy Group, which really sits at the interface between the universities, the 26 universities, and the world of work, the employers and so on. And the idea is really to try and understand how to lever greater partnerships between the universities and the private sector. And I think that we have to keep working at that. You know, that we have to try and make sure that this is not just something that happens at points of crisis, if you like, but that's something that becomes something that's very a part of the natural operations of our education system. And you mentioned the NGO sector. I want to add to that, you know, community-based organizations, the trade union movement, and so on. All of them have serious kind of all of them have serious roles to play in building the capacity of universities to be optimal in what they achieve. It addresses another question, I think, which is perhaps a more serious question. And that is that it addresses this very powerful idea that we need to ensure that the ownership of universities becomes a public ownership. That, you know, universities are not seen as elite institutions, that they really belong to society. And that if we can galvanize these partnerships, then we embed our universities in the communities and in the society in which they exist. So generating these partnerships is critically important, as I understand it, at least.
And lastly, Prof, this year marks 5 years since the Fees Must Fall protest, where students were calling for a decolonization of education and more financial support for students who are from poor families. How far are we in meeting those demands?
So let me just say that, one of the outcomes of the Fees Must Fall campaign is, in fact, you know, what we refer to as the DHET bursaries, you know, the NSFAS administered bursaries. And, you know, however you want to cut it, those bursaries are really important. They've really played a critical role in ensuring that, thousands of students who would not otherwise have been able to go to university are now able to go to university. Now, that's not the full story, of course, because, you know, we still are struggling to understand how to meet the needs of the missing middle and you know, this category of students that we spoke about earlier. And that's something which we haven't yet resolved. There are a number of projects underway at the moment to try and understand how to meet the needs of that category of students. And of course, if Fees Must Fall did not happen, the likelihood is we would not have had these, you know, this progress. So I'm not suggesting at all that the solutions have all been met. But what I am suggesting is that I think there's a lot of work going on to deal with the needs of the missing middle students, and that we need to focus our attention there now. And as I mentioned earlier, for those students that fall into what the government calls poor and working class families, that those needs of those students, in essence, have been met now. On the issue of decolonization, I'm really pleased to say that there's a lot of work going on in our sector. And it's happening at different levels. You know, on the one hand, it's happening at the sectoral level. There are a whole range of national discussions going on. But at the same time, every single university has got projects underway to deal with the issue of the decolonized university, if you like. Now, I'm not suggesting at all that we are there, right? I mean, I think that this is a very challenging, very difficult, very kind of deep, a deep set of changes that that we need to kind of implement, if you like. But at the same time, there's a tremendous amount of really interesting work going on at our universities to address the issues around the decolonization of the curriculum and so on. At USAF itself, one of our focuses is to try and understand, what is the driving force in trying to understand what an engaged institution is. an institution that's really deeply rooted in its realities and in the context in which it finds itself. Because in a sense, that has to be at the basis of what we think of as a decolonized institution. You know, clearly we are global institutions, but we can only enter the global terrain on the basis that we are generating knowledge about our local context, right? You know, it's only on those terms that we can enter the global knowledge system on our own terms, if you like. You know, we should set the knowledge project for our universities. And that's what we are, it's a really big project at USAF at the moment.
And finally, from me, Professor Bauer, at the beginning of the lockdown, one of the more contentious conversations surrounded the ending of the academic year, with many people arguing that it wasn't a practical solution to the issue at hand. From your expertise, could you please take us through why it may have been impractical to simply end the academic year and start again in 2021?
Yeah, well, you know, the school system, of course, produces a significant number of matriculants every year, right? So had we not found ways to complete the 2020 academic year, it would have meant that we would have had a whole cohort of matriculants, a whole cohort of students finishing with the National Senior Certificate who would not have been able to come into university simply because the universities are already operating at capacity, if you like. So it was critically important for us to ensure that we complete the academic year to ensure that the next cohort of young people coming through the National Senior Certificate system would gain access to universities for the 2021 academic year. So that's the one issue. There's a second issue, of course, and that is that our society and the economy and so on requires a constant flow of graduates into the economy and into the hospitals and into the schools and so on. I don't know whether you know this, but you know, the university system produces about 220,000 graduates a year. And those students, those graduates really get absorbed into the, you know, into the labor market, if you like. So it's critically important. It was always critically important that we found interesting and important ways to complete the academic year, 2020 academic year. As you know, the start of the 2021 academic year is only going to be between March and April. It will be staggered for the different universities, and it will only be March and April. And what that means in essence is that the 2021 academic year is going to have to be carefully kind of repackaged, if you like, so that we can finish that academic year at the end of 2021.
We've just been joined by Professor Ahmed Bauer here on the COVID Report, CEO of University South Africa, helping us discuss the plight of the students who fall within the missing middle and discussing the ways in which everyone needs to pull together to make sure the playing field is evened out for everybody playing on it. Speaking of, it's no use to find the thoughts and sentiments on a matter as sensitive as this, then you yourselves, the students, and those who may feel as if they are part of this missing middle. We went out to find out what the students feel about the adaptation to online learning, the practicalities and the logistics of staying with online learning, whether or not they would prefer going back to the way things were or fully embracing the new way of doing things, the new normal, so to speak. This is what a few of these students had to say.
It's quite unfortunate that the structure of things is either, you know, here to cater for those who are able to afford and those who absolutely have no level of affordability at all. And it kind of leaves those in the middle. So how do we then cater for the ones who are really, really in the middle? And they can make it, but also to an extent they can't make it. And I think ideally for me, what would work is not even categorizing. Just don't categorize. Give people what they deserve. Award students with what they need to, you know, improve their education, improve their academic skills. And I think with that, maybe we could be moving towards something greater. Let those who deserve it reap them.
I think government should do is they should sort of, if NASFAS doesn't accept the students or the upcoming students, then government should then step in and do something about that, because that's just another batch of people who are unemployed, who are just in the system, but they're not working with the system. They're not providing to the economy, you know. So yeah, that's just what I think.
There should be a fund that is almost similar to NSFAS, but in this way where we are regarded as our parents are getting over the 350,000 bracket per annum. So I think there should be a fund where the government and the universities, we pay half, and the government is able to help us pay half, the other half, so that, you know, we can at least lessen the number of dropouts at university levels. Most of us, we normally take gap years so that we can go make money, come back to pay for the fees. Because it's also, it's even hard. It's hard, I don't want to lie. So I've realized, Tori, if government can meet us halfway, we pay half the money, and they are able to subsidize half the other money, and we pay it the same way as NSFAS, I think it would be much better. Yes.
There should be at least a certain percentage of which students whose parents earn between 360 upwards pay. Because now it also puts parents in a pressure. We have parents, by law, they earn more than 360 or between that, and they have other responsibilities. We have parents who don't support only one child, they support multiple children. And it doesn't mean, or if parents earn a certain amount of money, which is 360 upwards, then they don't have other responsibilities. You know, we have students whose parents earn this amount of money, but still don't have proper resources, study resources. They still don't have proper study environments or accommodation. So simple, there should just be at least a certain amount of percentage money that is deducted from these students who fall under the brackets, or whose parents fall under the brackets. That's the only solution. Or if that's not the case, at least there should be a different bursary that cater for those students.
I think first of all, maybe government needs to review the sort of perimeter that they use to gauge if someone qualifies for NSFAS, because maybe they sort of load the bar too much, because there are some students who come from families where even if it looks like they afford, but there are other costs that they have to take care of as a family, so they can't afford fees. I think government must just increase the bar, or sort of, I don't know, they increase the bar or lower, just to make sure they accommodate them as well, because they might be below the so-called NSFAS range, but in actual fact they can't afford. Or also, government must encourage more companies to expand their bursary schemes or their student apprenticeship schemes, just to make sure they, as private players, sort of take a leading role in training, because these students are their future employees, so they must be involved during the training process.
A big thank you to everyone who has just lent their voices to this discussion. Also, a big thank you to our guest, Professor Ahmed Bauer, who helped us kick off this discussion about the plight of the students who identify as being part of the missing middle.
This podcast was brought to you by Voice of Vids. By Voice of Vids. To hear more of our shows, tune in to 88.1. Or stream via www.vofm.co.za.